Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Dr. Jeff Jarvis, someone that it has been a couple of years since the last time we talked to, has had some pretty big stuff come out. In fact, he's been published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, and it's one of the big things that we want to talk to him about today, along with just some, kind of some other topics as well. But before we dive in too deep, Jeff, can you kind of give us a reminder of who you are for the people who may not have heard all the podcasts from the beginning, because you're on very, very early on the podcast.
Absolutely, Chip. First, thanks for having me back on. It's good to talk to you again. My name is Jeff Jarvis. I am a paramedic. I'm an emergency physician, and I'm an EMS physician. I practice emergency medicine at Baylor Scott & White Hospital in Round Rock, Texas. We're a community hospital, and I'm the medical director for Williamson County EMS, which is the county just to the north of Austin, and Marble Falls area EMS, which is a smaller system to the west of Austin.
And you mentioned this, that you mentioned this on the last podcast too, that you're a paramedic. How long have you been a paramedic for before you became a physician?
I'm not sure I want to answer that. It seems to make me pretty old. I became a paramedic. I started my first job as a paramedic in December of 1988. So I've been a paramedic for almost 30 years now.
Wow, that's awesome. So obviously you've had lots of field experience, which I think is a great way to incorporate this, because of all that experience, you are very used to both the hospital and out-of-hospital environments, which was a perfect segue to the career that you've been doing. And I mean, it's been funny, and hopefully it may not happen again, but you even answered a medical control call while we were kind of setting up the interview and everything else. Exactly. So, I mean, you're very active with your EMS agencies, which I think is a great model and something that I'm missing in my local areas. I wish we had more of that true involvement with it, because what you're able to do and the studies and everything else is what makes, I think, your EMS agency unique from, let's just say, the baseline EMS agency.
Sure, I would definitely agree. When I have conversations about some of the things that we're doing, or when I have conversations about some of the literature, I always try to make a point that we have to look at EMS both from a pragmatic standpoint across the country. What is the default? And then what are the high-performing agencies doing? And it doesn't always have to be the same thing. And what works well in a high-performing agency may not work in the default agency. So there are definitely some differences there.
Speaking of these differences, my buddy Tyler Cristofoli over at Foam Frat has had you on for some recent stuff, including interviews with the recent authors for the cardiac arrest trials that involved advanced airways. One of the big things you mentioned about, and I know is one thing that gets highly controversial with it really quickly, because everyone wants to feel like they're the exception to the rule, but I feel like there's a couple of reasons why you are the exception to the rule for what you're talking about and what your paper did, which we'll go over here in a second. I just wanted to get your thoughts about the Parts and Airways 2 trial and what you believe maybe makes your system just a little bit different, or the things we need to take away from that in general.
That's a great question. Those two studies are, I think, some of the best evidence that we have. Actually, they are the best evidence that we have about airway management and cardiac arrest. We can certainly limit this to out of hospital, although I'm not sure, because that was the setting for those trials, but I think it's probably applicable to the hospital also. And what those two studies, you might say they have conflicting results, but I think overall they have the same results, which is, there is not a clear advantage to either supraglottics or endotracheal intubation. And I say that realizing that the PART study in their primary analysis showed an advantage of about 2.9% absolute risk reduction with King LT over ETI. Rather than go into why, I'm not terribly convinced by that. I would say that overall, I think it's showing that there is not a great advantage one way or the other. The big challenge with those studies, certainly the PART trial, is it does not look like endotracheal intubation was done particularly well. They had a first pass success rate of 51%. And perhaps that contributed to that 2.9% higher survival in the King LT group. We just don't know. There's also no information about how the intubation was done and whether there are compression interruptions. But that's being nitpicky. I think it's valid, but overall, there's some good information there that says your default system really should probably consider using a supraglottic device. Now, the next statement, which really gets to your initial question, is, well, how is your system different? Well, I will tell you, my system is different because we pay really close attention to our CPR performance. We look at our compression interruptions, and we pay a lot of attention to airway management. We have a first-pass success rate in cardiac arrest anywhere from 88 to 92% without interrupting compressions. So I think that's the main thing I can point to and say that's different. And that's why I'm struggling to know how to interpret and implement the results from PART and Airways 2. Now, the other thing that I want to say, though, is I think these two papers were good science. And I think you neglect good science at your own risk. So I don't want to give the idea that I'm just saying, well, that doesn't apply to me. I think a majority of people with the pre-study bias, if you will, of intubation is the best way to do this are going to look for reasons to nitpick it so that it matches their prior conclusion, if you will. And I'm trying desperately not to do that. So that's one of the reasons that I'm still thinking really hard about what the best way to manage airways and cardiac arrest is, despite the fact that I think our systems are different than the ones in these two studies.
And I know you're probably like me, you've probably reread those studies multiple times over trying to figure out, because there's so much data in there, there's so much information that it's one of those things, you're exactly right. You don't want to nitpick and say that, well, you're the exception to the rule, because that's what everyone wants to do right now. But
and that's what everyone on Twitter is saying.
Exactly. Everyone feels like they're the exception, but are they actually the exception?
Of course. Yeah.
This is why I like your paper, because your paper comes out around the same time. But your paper is very different with a couple of key components. But just like you said, you have high first pass success rates in cardiac arrest still. But obviously, I'm guessing that your people were not in either one of these studies, which obviously, you know, kind of takes a little bit differently. But I think the big thing overall is just the main takeaway from those trials. If your EMS is a standard agency that doesn't have all these great bundles in place, like what you've got going on, which we'll talk about here more in a second, you really are the default. You really are the baseline EMS agency that probably can not necessarily go with the intubation first route, maybe more of the supraglottic airway approach route first. That's kind of my general takeaway with it so far reading it. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And if you're wondering about whether you're a high performance agency or not, I guess this is a little bit like if you're in a room wondering who the asshole is, then perhaps you're the asshole.
Did you steal that from Justified? That's one of my favorite lines from that show.
I don't know if I did. I've watched that. Maybe. I think it's a great show. I do like the series. I don't know. Maybe I did.
No.
Attribution error. So if you're wondering if you are a high performance EMS system, well, the easiest way to answer that is actually look at your data. Take a look at what is your first pass success rate for in intubation of cardiac arrest patients. What's your first pass success rate? What's your overall success rate? What is the proportion of intubations done intra-arrest where you interrupt compressions for more than, well, if you interrupt compressions, period. What is your proportion of arrest with or without intubation where you have pauses longer than 7 to 10 seconds? What is your compression fraction? And I'm not asking you to make things up. If you don't know the data, you're probably not one of those systems. You're probably the default system. Recall bias is a real issue. You think you're better than you really are. We certainly found that in the first study we did at my system, which was VL versus DL, when we just ask people, how good are we at intubation? Oh, we're great. Well, what do you suppose our first pass success rate is? Oh, it's easily 90%. Yeah, it was actually 41%, I think. So when you look at the data, you find ugly things. So if you're not looking at the data, just save me. Don't say a word about how great your system is. Because if you don't have the data to back it up, I don't believe you.
And that's something I feel like is really hard in the rule agencies, because I mean, where I'm working at, I'm working rural. And so we usually, even though we don't have necessarily the high numbers, because you kind of talk about this in your paper, and I feel like we keep alluding to the paper, we should probably eventually talk about it. But one of the things that you mentioned was that if you have a lot of paramedics, or if you're an agency that really doesn't have an extensive QI setup, that this probably isn't quite the thing you'll be able to more easily get done, should we say. But that's my thing with the rural settings is usually we don't have the QIQA system in place. We don't have necessarily the high abundance of need for innovation. So it makes it really hard for our EMS to get the experience and to get the numbers to actually really know, are they doing stuff well? Really, how many times are they truly first pass success? Which again, with your paper, I mean, you even talk about how you have another paramedic who's kind of observing the whole process and has the stopwatch. I really love the stopwatch. I mean, that's high performance right there. There's no doubt that that's high performance EMS right there at its finest.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. So there is a sweet spot, I think, and I've been thinking about this quite a bit as a medical director. There is a sweet spot. So if you are working for a system that's too small, then you're not going to have the resources you need to look into things. You're not going to have somebody to do the QA, QI on an ongoing basis. You're not going to have the resources to pay somebody to do it. You're honestly not going to have the resources to pay a medical director to do this full time. And you're not going to have the call volume where you have the experience. And on the other side of the curve, if you will, these mega departments that have hugely high call volume and they have the resources to do the quality improvement, the other thing they classically have is a crap ton of paramedics. So if you have paramedics on every engine, every street corner, you may have more calls, you may have more intubations, but you dilute that by increasing the denominator, the number of paramedics. So you end up with this skill dilution issue. So even though you have the resources to do the QI, you probably don't have the ratio of paramedic to procedure so that your success rate drops. And then you also, the larger you get, the more likely it is that you're going to be dealing with some union issues that inhibit your ability to actually do something with the results from your quality improvement. So the sweet spot is right in the middle.
You talked about really large departments. I don't know. I don't want to name the specific department just because of how low the rates are. But I was able to talk to one of their basically medical directors about their setup. And this very large, very well done EMS department that is a combination fire EMS department, they went through and they reviewed how many intubations per paramedic they had annually, and it was 0.8. And that's really hard to keep up their competence for it, especially if they're not getting the exposure in the field for it. So they really weren't doing the training to keep up with it. And they actually took away, in some aspects, they took away all pediatric intubations. And I think they kind of restricted the use of adult intubations because they were having such little exposure to it.
Absolutely. This is the concept of skill dilution. And skill dilution is a real issue. It's something that I struggle with all the time. We do about 28,000 calls a year, and we have 130 paramedics. If I were designing the system from scratch, I would probably have half as many paramedics. Now, I'm not designing the system from scratch. We have 130 great paramedics that are wonderful people and have families to support, so I would never change the system we have. But doing it from scratch, I would like to have fewer paramedics. And our ratio right now, we do 2.8, I think, intubations per paramedic per year, and that's adult only. I looked at our stuff with pediatrics, and we intubated one child per paramedic per 2.5 careers. So I just can't justify the investment in training to try to maintain competence with that, particularly when we have superglottics that do just as good a job.
I feel like now, since we've been alluding at this for about 15 minutes, let's talk about your actual paper and how...
Now we can avoid it a little longer.
Don't worry, we'll only talk about it for about 5 minutes, and then we'll talk about other stuff. We'll just gloss right
exactly,
over it.
Exactly. Let's talk sepsis. Sure.
So tell us about, I mean, again, people can listen to the older podcast. I almost cringe when I say that just because it was so long ago. I probably did something horrible when I was recording with you. And I apologize for everything I did horrible before. But yeah, let's talk about this paper, about why, you know, again, you've talked about, you've got systems in place, you're full time with this, you really worked so hard to get this paper basically perfect. I mean, it was impressive. But what in the end was the general approach? What did you do? What data did you find? You know, kind of just walk us through this, because this is such a cool paper.
Well, thank you very much. And the one thing I'll say, I do think it's a pretty tight paper, and I have to I have to thank Henry Wang. Dr. Wang was the senior editor for Annals on this paper, and the paper that got published is so much better than my first submission because of the outstanding work that he did. Even the peer review on this paper was very, very helpful. So I think the product that actually got published is much better than what we started off with. So to give you a summary, this was a retrospective before and after study based on the data at Williamson County EMS. And the key thing that we were looking for was whether we could decrease the proportion of patients who suffered peri-intubation hypoxia with this clinical bundle of care. So this component, there were several components of this bundle. So we used, and just to be clear, we're only looking at patients not in cardiac arrest. So we excluded all cardiac arrest. And that may get a little confusing because our prior discussion was about airway management in cardiac arrest. So full stop, different population, non-arrest patients. And the bundle that we had was positioning, and our positioning was head up at a 15 degree in an ear to sternal notch position, or as I like to say, a pint sipping position. If you think about sipping a pint, or at least a full pint, you'll get that position. Head elevated, pint sipping position. We used apneic oxygenation at flush rates. We used delayed sequence intubation on 100% of our patients using ketamine, and then the vast majority of our patients we used rocuronium on. There were some that we used succinylcholine on, and the difference was really what we could get. We had some shortages in there. We also used a bag valve mask with PEEP for our pre-oxygenation after ketamine. Made sure we had a good seal using a two hands thumb down approach. And then we reached an oxygen saturation of 94% or higher and maintained it continuously for 3 minutes. If we didn't achieve that 3 minutes of pre-oxygenation at or above 94%, then we would not push the rocuronium and wouldn't proceed with the intubation. So that was the clinical bundle. And again, all of them were present for every patient. If we didn't achieve that, we didn't intubate. Well, let me back that up. We didn't push the rocuronium. We might have placed a supraglottic device. And if we needed to use, if the medic felt like they needed to use rocuronium to pass the supraglottic, they could do that, but they could not intubate hypoxic patients. Our primary outcome was the proportion of patients with peri-intubation hypoxia. In the before trial, we had 44% of our patients have peri-intubation hypoxia. In the after group, meaning after intubation or after implementation of this bundle, that proportion dropped to 3.5%. So 44% versus 3.5%, and that was a difference of 41%. And the confidence interval on that was anywhere from 50% to 32%. So it made a substantial decrease. We also saw an increase in the median low value from 93% up to 100%. And obviously, we saw a decrease in the number of cases of peri-intubation hypoxia. So that's the study in a nutshell. There were several things that we did the same in both of these groups. So we are an exclusively video laryngoscopy shop. That was what we discussed in our first paper. I've actually taken direct laryngoscopy off of the ambulances completely. And I'm sure people are going to at me about that. I think that Twitter battle finally died down, so we may as well stir it.
Quick question before we stir the pot too much there. Now, back when we did our last podcast a couple of years ago, you actually still had some DL on the trucks as like a backup, wasn't it, for the for like specific choking, for like doing the McGills, or was there something like that? Do you still do that, or is that gone now as well?
It's actually gone now. We did not have enough experience using the King LT to clear an airway, so I left a Miller blade on there. But since then, we found that using the device, we have been able to clear the airway with McGill's. So it is VL only now.
Awesome. I'm excited for that. I mean, we're going to start all sorts of controversy there, but I'm excited about that.
Yeah, interestingly, my interest in that debate has waned substantially. you know, I think it's very much like the – and Twitter will do this to you, I guess. Trying to have a debate on Twitter is kind of pointless. But I'm not trying to change anybody's opinion at this point. Honestly, I think VL is going to take over the world anyway. The old farts just have to die off. I think it'll happen, and I'm not really interested in changing people's religion at this point.
Well, at least you're not one of the old farts then, so you don't have to die off. That's the
Well, I'm proof that you can teach an old dog new tricks.
Well, and that was actually one of the things we talked about last time was about you learning VL and how to do it, and basically the sales rep telling you that you're an idiot.
Yeah, that was embarrassing.
But that's,
sometimes that's how you have to get through to the old dogs, is beat them over the head.
Oh yeah, and that's not even the old dogs thing. That's just anyone who's learning something new. I mean, how often?
Sure.
When we learn ultrasound or stuff like that, I mean, it's a big learning curve to do something that you've never done before and then adopt that. And I think this is the thing you can argue with this too. It's not necessarily that we don't do any one of these things. It's we don't do it all together. We don't always do the process of what's essentially here DSI. I mean, this is at least partly DSI with just...
Well, you know, I actually thought that. And I mentioned that Dr. Wang made this a much better paper through his feedback to me. My initial title of the paper was Implementation of DSI. I thought this paper was about DSI. And he said, Jeff, this is not about DSI. This is about a clinical bundle. It is about making sure that you do all of the things that we know prevent peri-intubation hypoxia, combining them into one bundle and doing that. So I can't say that the 41% drop in peri-intubation hypoxia was a function of DSI, or was it a function of PEEP, or was it a function of positioning? What was it a function of? I don't know. I can say it wasn't of apneic oxygenation alone, because we were using apneic oxygenation in the before group. And I can say it wasn't video laryngoscopy, because we were doing that in the before group. The only thing the science allows me to say is that bundle made the difference.
Well, and this is the tricky thing about correlation, causation, stuff like that.
I was going to say, just to be pedantic about it, was associated with. Sorry, it wasn't a randomized controlled trial, so I can't say that. My guess is that it would work. Actually, I don't know about that, because if I randomize this, that means I would take two groups. The paramedics in both groups would understand the importance of peri-intubation hypoxia or avoiding it, and it's not like I can tell them, don't go ahead and intubate a hypoxic patient. And if they're not hypoxic, make them hypoxic. It's not really ethical to do.
Right. And I think that's one of the things we have to take away from this trial, is this may be something that could be done possibly at another EMS agency, but not yours at this point because of what you developed and put in place.
Yeah. In Texas, we say they're ruined now.
So I think a couple of quick things to talk about, a little bit of limitations in your paper, just so as we're thinking forward about this, we can know the potential limitations with it. One, you've got a potential Hawthorne effect because your people know that they're being studied. That's kind of a classic thing there. So could they just be knowing that they need to do better in the after group? I think another thing you're talking about is the correlation causation, which we already mentioned. And then one thing that's not really as much as a point, but something I wanted you to hopefully clarify for me as I was reading through the paper again, your before and after groups overlap on dates. So your before group ended December 13th, 2015, but your after group started on August 8th, 2015. Can you explain that to me?
Yes, I can. It actually turns out to be pretty easy if I'm talking to you. It turns out to be incredibly difficult to say this concisely in a paper. We had a phase-in group. So we, like all good quality improvement efforts, we did this on a PDSA cycle. So we started small and looked at our experience with that and then expanded it out. So we took four groups of people and we said, four crews, and we said, we're going to teach you how to do this. And then we're going to watch how it works. So they did it, those select group of paramedics. All of their non-cardiac arrest intubations, they used this bundle on, while the rest of the system didn't know we were doing it. So they continued on. We did that for four or five patients. We evaluated how the process worked, and then we implemented it out over the system. When we divided our patients up into groups for the purpose of this before and after study, we did it based on whether they had the bundle or whether they didn't have the bundle. So that's the reason there's overlap. It's because of that phase-in process.
And that's kind of what I figured, because like you said, it's the usual kind of way to implement this. But I just don't want anyone looking at the paper to think that was some sort of error or to not understand why that was going on. So I appreciate you clarifying that.
You bet. And speaking of that, the one other thing that I would like to point out, I heard a journal club where they were discussing this, and they had, this actually shocked me, they had a statistician who said I was hiding something in my data tables because I didn't report p-values. They're kind of full on. I actually did report p-values. I know how to calculate a p-value. It's not that hard. Lauren Sager is a statistician. She ran it in Stata. I ran it in R. I know how to do a p-value. Annals told me to take my p-values and shove them because of the inherent limitations in p-values. So if you don't see a p-value, that's because Annals told me not to, and I actually agree with not doing it. I think the confidence interval is a much better way of approaching it.
I, you know, the more and more I have done statistics outside of the, I guess, my undergraduate environment, the more I appreciate how shitty p-values truly are.
Yeah, they're very misleading. But this p-value is really small, so it must be really significant.
It must be really, it's too perfect. Yeah.
That's not how that works.
That's not how any of this works.
Exactly. How about we just not use it if it's that misleading?
Now, we've talked about how you did this, and just, I think, kind of talking about this approach in general, what makes your agency so different is because of some of the safeguards you have in place. Now, it's very easy for me as the one person who is doing the airway to say, oh, I think I've done it for 3 minutes now, or I think I've done the steps I'm supposed to do, and oh, I only actually did one first pass versus I did it multiple times. You have something in your system I think is profound and something that we should be doing no matter what environment we're in. And that is having a second person actually monitor us as we're doing this, not looking over our shoulder, waiting for us to screw up, but simply to make sure that we are actually taking all the appropriate steps, that we're actually doing our airway approach the way we're supposed to be doing it versus the way we think we're actually doing it.
Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting. We would frequently think, well, it's easier for me to, say, use this bundle in the emergency department where I'm in control of everything than in the field. And I'm going to use my anecdotal N of one, meaning me. When I try to do this in the emergency department, it is unbelievably difficult. It is like herding cats. The rest of my department just does not want any part of it. And RT in particular does not want any part of it. I tell them that I want to give ketamine and pre-oxygenate, and they look at me like I am smoking crack. It is really challenging. Just the fact that I want to intubate the patient with the head up, it's like they can't understand that. The concept of using apneic oxygenation or of applying end-tidal CO2 before the intubation. Hell, just the idea of not using that stupid colorimetric end-tidal CO2, actually using waveform CO2 that is at the bedside, using it is a challenge. So I'm sorry, that's my little rant.
No, these are my same ramps. Totally agree. Every time I mention like, hey, I want end-tidal CO2 on this patient, they just kind of look at me funny. Like, what the hell? We have these color things here. No. Like, if you have to, we can start with that, but this is bullshit. Let's move over to what actually we need. And you would not believe.
But that's hard.
Well, actually, it sounds like you can believe the resistance to this.
Absolutely. It's It is unbelievable. It's really a challenge. For example, I'll do my intubations with ketamine as the sedative instead of Etomidate. Well, our RSI boxes in the emergency department have Etomidate in there.
Uh-huh.
And I'll say, okay, I want to use ketamine. Well, we don't have ketamine. We have Etomidate. I understand what's in the box. You have this thing called a Pyxis. Why don't you go get it? Well, we have to intubate them right now. No, actually, we don't. Let's slow this down. I am oxygenating the patient. I'm ventilating the patient. Go get the ketamine. Well, that's hard. You know what? We're not here for us. We're here for the patient. Let's do it right.
Oh my gosh. I feel like we're totally on the same page here. What I've actually started doing now, and the nurses have figured this out, most of them have figured this out, is I say, grab the RSI kit and ketamine, both. Like, just go ahead and grab both right now, because I know it's not in our RSI kit. I want that changed, but you know, we had a while where we had the shortage of Rocuronium, which it sounds like you did too. Mm-hmm. And that was a total bear, because then we had to use, Vec's not as big a deal, but we're using, some weird drug that no one actually knew the actual dosing for, and I had to look it up every time. But I mean, those little things like that just totally throw you off. And now the rest of your intubation attempt, the whole process behind it is just kind of shook up a little bit. Same thing goes on when you're trying to ask someone to get something different. It just blows my mind. Like, come on, just grab the ketamine at the same time. You know this is what I'm going to want.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that the advantage that I have, I would much rather intubate a patient in the field with my crews than I would in the hospital. I've been doing this for a couple of years, so the nurses that have been working with me understand what I want to do. But it's still a bit of a challenge. And for them, it's hard because I'm one out of, 8-9 doctors. I do it differently. So it's a bit of a challenge. In the field, we do it the same way every time. So it's actually very nice. And by the way, I'm not complaining about my nurses. I love them. I have some outstanding nurses, and I couldn't do my job without them. It's a function of how you train as a team, and that's what we're able to do in the field more so than I'm able to do in the hospital.
Absolutely. And like you said, you've got personality differences. Like with the EMS agency, you can say, this is our standard, this is our protocol approach, this is what happens every time, versus in the ED, everyone's got a little bit of a different flavor. I think... Yeah. All of us in my department manage the airways slightly different. Fortunately, at night, because I work strictly nights, and so do the docs that I work with, almost all of them work only nights. The main benefit is our nighttime RTs and our nighttime nurses and everyone else, they're on the same page at this point. Now, instead of trying to figure out 20 personalities and 20 different approaches to the airway, they know about 4 or 5. So it makes it a lot easier for us to manage this. But it's still a challenge because, again, we're not protocolized. And maybe that's something that we kind of need to look at is should we just have a protocolized approach? But then you get people who are outside their element, just like I'm sure you had people outside their element when they were doing your approach for this paper.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it. The other issue is with my system, I control the training, I control the protocols, and we train on this constantly. So every medic goes through a simulation where we do a full, we call them DSIs as though the entire bundle. When we say DSI, really, we mean this bundle. We do at least one of those per medic per month. So we train really hard on this just to keep it in everyone's mind. You can't do that in the emergency department. There are just too many people working different schedules. It's a real challenge. Not to mention, I'm in Texas. I can tell my paramedics how to do it. We run off of a protocol. You and I don't work off of protocols in the emergency department.
Right. We've got to talk a little bit about your paper on this before we kind of move on to the next part, because this is just too great to have you on and talk about all the different things. It's been, we had 30 minutes of great audio before we even really got started on the actual recording. But is there anything else you want to specifically mention about your paper?
So my main points on this paper is that peri-intubation hypoxia is common and it's harmful. What do I mean by common? Well, in my system, I found 44% of intubations, non-cardiac arrest intubations, were associated with peri-intubation hypoxia. The literature supports numbers between 33 and 50%. So it's not just us. This is consistent both in the hospital and out of the hospital. And we know it's harmful. It's associated with bradycardias, hemodynamically significant bradycardias, as well as cardiac arrest. So Dr. Mort did this very nice paper that looked at in-hospital intubations, RSIs, 3% of them were associated with peri-intubation cardiac arrest. And that's actually how we got interested in this, is we had a peri-intubation arrest that I looked at, and it was very clear we were the ones who caused that arrest. We caused harm. So peri-intubation hypoxia is common, and it's harmful. You can, however, avoid it, and that's my second part. The best way to avoid it is not intubate hypoxic patients. In medicine, we frequently try to make things more complicated than they really are. This is easy. Don't intubate hypoxic patients. Dr. Weingart talks about this as resuscitate before intubate, and I think that's a very good concept. Fix the problem first, then proceed with the airway. The third part is that using a clinical bundle can fix that hypoxia so that you can intubate safely. And the components of that bundle, again, are positioning. So head of bed elevated, put them in an ear to sternal notch position, use flush rates of apneic oxygenation, make a good seal either with a BVM and PEEP or with non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, either CPAP or BiPAP. And use delayed sequence intubation to allow yourself to make sure that you have at least 3 minutes of pre-oxygenation where your oxygen saturations are above 93%, so 94 or higher. And also maximize your first pass success and do whatever, at this point, I'm just going to say use whatever you're good with and measure your success. And then the fourth point is that whatever you're doing, measure it. Measure it every time. Look at the data from your intubations, because if you're not measuring it, you really have no idea how well you're doing. And then finally, again, this worked well for us. Our proportion of peri-intubation hypoxia dropped from 44% to 3.5%. And I think if you adopt this same bundle, you can see similar drops.
The one thing I wanted to really mention on there that you kind of just glossed over, but it's the key of your paper, really. It's the whole crux of what your paper is actually all about, is this resuscitate then intubate approach, or resuscitate before you intubate. I call it resuscitate then intubate because they made an RTI podcast talking all about hop killers and stuff like that. So I like to call it RTI versus RSI versus DSI. I guess there's just all sorts of names for it. But for me, I like the RTI approach, because hypoxia is one part of that. The hemodynamics is another part. People often ignore the fact that they're hypotensive and they say, well, they have to be intubated now. It's like what we were talking about earlier. Everyone's right. So quick that they feel like that the tube is going to be the cure-all, when really it's not in most cases. It's part right. of the it's part of the entire approach to the resuscitation, but it's not the cure. So instead, we end up killing people in the process. And there have been a couple of patients where I get really frustrated by this. They were getting resuscitated. We did such a good job about doing the hemodynamic resuscitation, you know, addressing our hop killers before we intubated them. They actually perked up so much that they then didn't want to intubate them. And guess what happens later when you, right. I mean, bad things
return
happen.
To baseline.
Exactly. So that was such a frustrating part, because I've seen that and finally got those people convinced that that shouldn't be something you're doing anymore, because that's asking for someone to have a bad outcome later.
And to clarify that, the paper itself is just about hypoxia. By the time I was writing the manuscript, we had included hypotension. So I didn't include the hypotension, meaning hypotension is a barrier, will prevent you from intubating. Initially, because I understood this was a complex bundle and I wanted to minimize the number of changes we were doing. So we did this bundle, and a year later we added in the don't intubate hypotensive patients.
Okay, that was going to be one of my questions, so I'm glad you mentioned that as well. Because the other thing I wanted to ask you about with it, or I guess the other kind of limitation thing that I think people forget about, is although the hypoxia is obviously very important, technically it's not directly a patient-oriented outcome. It wasn't like you're measuring mortality, which is a very clear cutoff, a dichotomous approach with it. But fortunately, you aren't having these types of issues because of what you're doing, because you're addressing the hypoxia directly. So even though hypoxia is not something that the patient may directly care about versus I died or I had brain damage as a result or something along those lines, it's still something that very much I feel like is an important outcome measure and something that was very much easier for you to keep track of when it comes to actual data collection.
Absolutely right. My paper did use disease-oriented outcomes rather than patient ones because that's the data I had. Let's not think that hypoxia is a surrogate measure and it doesn't really have an impact on patient-oriented outcomes. I think if you would say, what is the ultimate patient-oriented outcome? What do patients care about? Well, they don't want to die. And the risk of death, the odds ratio for death with hypoxia in patients with traumatic brain injury is 3.9. That's a 280% increase in the odds of death. We mentioned that between 2 and 3% of all intubations in the emergency department end up in cardiac arrest. So that's kind of important. If you look at the mortality rate in traumatic brain injured patients with hypotension, it's high. So of all patients, there was a great study that Dr. Spate did out of Arizona, 13,000 patients with out-of-hospital traumatic brain injury. The overall mortality rate was 8.2%. Of patients that had neither hypotension nor hypoxia, the mortality rate was 5.6%. So that's obviously less. If you had one episode of hypotension, your mortality was 21%. If you had one episode of hypoxia, your mortality was 28%. But if you had both, the mortality was 44%. If you're an odds ratio kind of guy, and you want to express that in adjusted odds ratio, the odds ratio for death with hypotension is 4.4. With hypoxia, it's 6.6. And with both hypotension and hypoxia, the odds ratio is 13.2. So that's a 13.2-fold increase. Another way of saying that is 1,200% increase in the odds of death if you have hypotension and hypoxia. I'm not sure how you can come up with a more meaningful patient-oriented outcome than that. This matters.
That's why I'm not upset with at all why your outcome was hypoxia versus, again, something that's even more straightforward patient-oriented, because you've got the data to back up those numbers.
Absolutely. And I don't mean to minimize the importance of having a patient-oriented outcome in a study like mine. I think that's incredibly important. And I would love to look at it. The problem is this is a quality improvement study, and we didn't have that data. The mortality numbers that I discussed with you, those were in patients with traumatic brain injury. How well does that transmit or translate into patients with respiratory disorders? I don't know. How about other neurologic disorders? Well, I think that there is probably my guess here, and I don't have data to suggest this, but I don't see a reason why we should consider other patients with neurologic disorders any different than TBI patients. So stroke patients, I think, also don't tolerate hypoxia or hypotension. So we don't know the extent to how well that translates to other conditions, but again, I can't imagine it's a good thing.
All right. So Jeff, you've done such a great paper. It's been great talking to you about all the different parts and talking about parts and airways too and everything else. I feel like I'm taking up so much of your time, and it seems like the storms are rumbling in Texas right now, which is, I think, trying to be an omen for something about trying to end this. So one more time, just to make sure that the listeners can all get this together, because there are so many pearls out of this paper, and everyone needs to read this paper. It's not going to be free for much longer. If you've got Annals access, obviously, you can always read this later. And I made sure to download my PDF now to make sure to have it in the future. But can you go ahead and just kind of run us through the key points one more time?
So I would summarize this in several main points. Number one, peri-intubation hypoxia is common and it's harmful. We know that there's an increase in mortality with peri-intubation hypoxia. Number two, we can avoid peri-intubation hypoxia by being smart. Don't intubate hypoxic or hypotensive patients. Resuscitate before you intubate. Number three, in order to prevent this, use a clinical bundle. That clinical bundle for us was composed of positioning, head up, ear to sternal notch, the use of apneic oxygenation, forming a good seal with PEEP, and using DSI to assure 3 minutes of good pre-oxygenation denitrogenation with a saturation of 94% or higher, as well as doing the things you need to do to assure first pass success. Finally, measure what you do. If you're not measuring it, you're not going to adequately know what your performance is, and it's going to be hard to improve it. So for all of those patients out there who need to be intubated, let's do them a favor and really pay attention to this.
So thanks so much, Jeff, for coming on. It's a pleasure. It should not take us 2 years to hopefully talk next time. Hopefully I can see you up at WIMSA. I think we're going to be up there at the same time. But in the meantime, can you go ahead and give us the tagline, please?
Absolutely. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.